Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Aisha Irani, who is Associate Professor of Asian Studies at the University of Massachusetts. We're speaking with her about a fantastic new publication that is precisely the sort of publication that motivated us to branch out from Hindu studies to Indian religions broadly. Her new OUP book is The Muhammad Avatara, Salvation, History, Translation, and the Making of Bengali Islam. Aisha, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And it's a real pleasure to talk to you about my new book.
Ah, pleasure is mine. The Muhammad Avatara. So the making of Bengali Islam, you know, for many of our listeners, what do you mean by Bengali Islam? Can you say a bit about that?
Yeah, so in the context of what I do, I believe that all Islam, in some sense, is local Islam. And as Islam moved across geopolitical frontiers, it came to be localized. And the way I treat this localization is through the lens of translation. And what I'm studying is an early biography of the Prophet, the first to be written in Bengali for Bengalis, translated from Persian and Arabic sources into Bangla. And so I study the ways in which this translator localizes an Arab prophet within the cultural landscape of Bengal. And in that sense, I'm speaking about the formation of a Bengali Islam through the writing of a salvation history of Islam for Bengal.
You know, in answering the question about what is Bengali Islam, you've preempted another of my questions, which was essentially, what was your book about? What was your object of study? And so the book is entirely focused on this Bangla hagiography of the Prophet Muhammad, correct? Is that your primary data?
That's right. So the main focus of this book is a 17th century biography of the Prophet Muhammad entitled The Nabi Vangsha. It's been written by someone called Sayyid Sultan, who we know about through various period sources as a Sufi peer. And he basically writes this what I call a salvation history. It's written as a universal history in that it starts with cosmogony, goes through the traditional line of Judeo-Islamic prophets from Adam through Isa, and then moving on to a full-blown biography of the Prophet Muhammad himself.
And so why do you call it a salvation history?
Yeah, that's a good question. So by calling it a salvation history, I am talking about how history is divinely ordained. Yes, that all aspects of the past, present, and future are part of a cosmic plan. So in that sense, we are dealing with a religious history that has as its beginning the beginnings of the cosmos itself, and as divinely ordained by Allah, it runs through these various prophetic exemplar leading up to the life of the Prophet Muhammad. So Muhammad then becomes the telos of religious history, and he becomes the end point, so to speak, of this grand salvation history that Sayyid Sultan writes.
So twofold sort of broad view question. Are there other biographies of the Prophet Muhammad that this compares to? And maybe a flip side of that question is, are there others in the Indic context, Bengali or otherwise? Is this the only one that we see in this region?
Right. So I'll talk about the local context first and then move to the broader context. So in Bengal and for Bengal, Sayyid Sultan's work is the first biography, or the first, in fact, large-scale work written on Islam during the early modern period. And it becomes a pioneering text for later authors of prophetic biography to imitate. But his is the very first. So after him, you have authors such as Sheikh John, who writes his Rasul Bijoy. You have the Anbiya Bani Kabbo, written by Hayat Mahmood. But these are all 18th century texts, whereas Sayyid Sultan's magnum opus comes from the 17th century. So that's the Bengali context. More broadly, this biography translates what is known as the Qisasul Anbiya genre, or the Tales of the Prophet genre, which is comes to us in various different forms. An important version of this, these tales were written by Al-Kisai, an apocryphal author, and these were, you know, written in Arabic, and then the, Kisai's tales then became the exemplar that was then translated by various Persian authors into the Anha-i Payambaran in Persian by people like Juwairi, Muhammad Juwairi, by Nishapuri. And these then become the windows through which Sayyid Sultan receives the Qisasul Anbiya, or the Tales of the Prophets. And while his translation seems to follow Kisai in many details, he also, I believe that it is through a Persian exemplar that he is receiving much of Kisai.
What Indic influences do we see in this text? Perhaps we could even touch on the title, the Muhammad Avatara.
The ways in which the prophet comes to be localized within a Bengali context is sort of key to the sophisticated strategies of translation that this author uses. And the Muhammad Avatar sort of is encapsulates, in some sense, as you point out, the ways in which translation functions within this text. So in the text itself, Muhammad is referred to by the author as Allah's own avatar, yes? And he is also referred to as the Kali avatar, or the avatar for the Kali age. And in this sense, the author is using translation as a way not only just to enculturate the prophet within the Bengali context, but to displace other rival religious traditions, including especially Vaishnavism. Yes? So during a period in the 16th century and in the 17th century particularly, Gaudiya Vaishnavism has become extremely popular in rural Bengal. And one of the overt and explicit missions of our author in writing his text is to create a rival text to the various traditions and tales of Ram and Krishna that he hears in the Bengal countryside. So not only is he now enculturating Muhammad to Bengal, but he's also creating, setting up a rival for not only Krishna within this this multi-religious environment, but he is also attempting now to displace not only Krishna, but Krishna Chaitanya, who was the founder of the Gaudiya Vaishnav movement, and who was also known in the Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition as the Kali avatar.
I just find it so fascinating, the cross-pollination. And of course, we have no choice but to anachronistically perhaps try to slice and dice things and see them through the lenses of scholarship and world religions. And if somebody held a gun to your head and asked, is this an... you have to answer, is this an innovation of Indic religion, or is this an Islamic innovation, or is it both? How might one think of that?
The cross-pollination as being an...
Is this text innovating? Yeah, is this text innovating Indic religion, Islamic religion, or both?
Well, I think it is doing both, right? In terms of innovation, I think any new religious tradition is going to bring in aspects of continuity and change, yes? So any new religion coming into a landscape where there is a multi-religious landscape is going to bring in elements of the past, whether it be, the past that comes from another geographical area, or the past of that particular geographical area, the target culture in which it wants to now find a new home. In some sense, manipulation of the original environment, in this case, say, Arabic and Persian sources, is taking place in order to now reformulate the Arabic and Persian traditions of the prophets for Bengal. At the same time, what our author is very uniquely doing is that he is reformulating tales of Krishna himself, who he is now bringing into this line of prophets as a new prophet. And Krishna, in Sayyid Sultan's retelling, is a miserable failure as a prophet. And he creates an entire parodic meta-text of the tales of Krishna that we hear from the Bhagavat that have probably reached him through various oral renditions of Krishna Leela performances in Bengal.
That's incredibly fascinating. What is the central takeaway argument of the book? What are you arguing for?
There are many takeaways. I think that one of the important takeaways is that the book offers a fresh look at how Islamization took place in Bengal. And I think that this is a rather understudied area. And we have, for instance, two very important works that were written in the 80s and the 90s. The first was that of Oshim Roy, who wrote his book, A Literary History of What He Called the Syncretistic Traditions of Bengal, where he proffered an analysis of how Islam reached the masses via what he called cultural mediators who breached the gap between great and little traditions. On the other hand, you have Richard Eaton's fabulous study of Bengal and its Islamization, especially under the Mughals, which brings together all kinds of data from Persian sources, as well as, you know, documentary, archaeological, geographical, topographical, art historical data to argue that it is the Sufis or pioneers on the Islamic frontier, the agrarian frontier, who ultimately were the ones to expand the frontiers of Islam in Bengal. My study looks at how Islam was, or conversion to Islam was represented to have happened in the writings of Sayyid Sultan. So rather than looking at how conversion to Islam happened, which is part of Richard Eaton's argument, I am now looking at Sayyid Sultan's past and his understanding of the past, or his recourse to the past, through the lens of what has come to be called nemo-history. This is a term coined by Jan Osman in his study of the past, and he uses this term to help us think about how people have remembered the past. And that is what I'm really concerned with in my study. I also use translation theory to create a model of how translation comes to entextualize conversion. So how translation of salvation history can now become part of the grammar of literization. Yes, how it comes to be put into literary form. And that is something that I provide a model for, a hermeneutical model for, which I think would sort of expands the ways in which we have begun to understand pre-modern translation. Another aspect of this study is that in some ways it opens up the importance of continuing to explore, you know, the various components of Islamization in Bengal. And I think one piece of that puzzle is that hasn't been so far studied is how Buddhism played, either the decline of Buddhism played into the Islamization of Bengal. And that's not something that has been studied in much detail. And I think that that is a complementary history that needs to be written about this time and place. The other aspect is that this study sort of lays bare the kinds of asymmetries of power on the ground in the early modern period. And while very little is known about Gaudiya Vaishnavism's spread into the southeast of Bengal, this text, because it emerges from Arakani's Chittagong, an area that was ruled by Buddhist rulers, it tells you, on the one hand, that Gaudiya Vaishnavism was on the rise, whereas Buddhism was not considered to be a threat by Muslims of that region for the spread of their faith.
Could you say a little bit more about the hermeneutic model that you adopt, that you advance, and maybe in tandem say something about who might be interested in this book, who may benefit from reading it?
Yes. So this model basically adopts Steiner's model of translation, while considering how translation comes to be influenced by principles of conversion. So essentially what I'm saying is that this model is underpinned by the fact that for Sayyid Sultan, faithfulness to an original text is not as important as being effectively understood by his audience. So for him then, communicating with his audience principles of Islam to make them as easily intelligible for his audience, that is more important than sticking to some kind of original text. And it's very interesting how when I was first reading this text, I kept, you know, fighting my own impulse for, you know, this hegemonic understanding of an original, and which is so much, you know, part of our modern day impulse with regard to understanding translation. But for a pre-modern author, it was much less important to stick to a source text than to be able to manipulate that source text in whatever way he needed to be able to communicate his ideals of Islam to his audience. So that is what this hermeneutic model is basically about.
May I just say...
Yes.
Please, may I just comment on that, and then perhaps you can talk about who might be interested. I can't help but draw comparisons, perhaps because I gave a class this morning on Puranas. It's part of an intro Indian religions course. It's what's it called? The textual tapestry. So this morning's class was on the Puranas, and there's this impulse, you know, scholarship has been struggling with this impulse to, you know, to find the real Purana, to find the critical text. You know, I was narrating the story of the beheading of Ganesha, or Ganesha's, how he got his elephant head. And due to the students, in the story, we use things like apps, and I was talking about Shiva needing anger management courses and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the point was not just regaling them with tales of old, because apparently I'm an incarnate bard, but the point was to share with them that the Puranas are dynamic. They're meant to reach the audience. They tell you that they're ancient, but they're telling you that it perhaps is a bit of an overcompensation, because what they really are is a current cultural software on how to package Indic ideas, advance a certain platform. And I just see such a parallel between the project of the Puranas, perhaps even the storytelling in general, and what you just said about your own research. So I had to interject, but please continue.
Since you bring up the Purans, I should also mention that what Syed Sultan is doing with the Nabi Vansha is really something quite fascinating. So before he begins his analysis of or presents the tale cycles of the traditional Islamic prophets from Adam to Isa and then on to Muhammad, he brings into this entire cosmogonic structure the Vaishnav avatars. So the Vaishnav avatars then create this entire this setup, this entire antecedent a genealogy that precedes Adam. And they become essentially failed prophets. Yes, and it is the failure of these Vaishnav avatars, including the Ram avatar, which then calls for the advent of Adam, and then Hari or Krishna is the only one of the, you know, Dashavatar or the 10 avatars of Vishnu who plays a prominent role within the Judeo-Islamic tale cycle itself. So the tale cycle of Hari then is interspersed between the tale cycle of Abraham and Moses. And then you have this is actually the place in the original Qisas ul-Anbiya tales where Joseph would typically have Yusuf. Yes, the tale of Yusuf would typically have come in. And Yusuf, of course, in many ways, is this prophetic exemplar who is both beautiful in and of himself and becomes, attractive to women. And so in that sense, Krishna becomes a suitable translational equivalent for Yusuf. And so we are having, here's another way in which translation operates within the text. And of course, when I was thinking about this, initially my impulse was, how can we call this part of the text a translation? What is it actually translating? And in fact, when you think about it, it becomes a symbolic translation of the Krishna tales in the Bhagavad. And so there are many elements of the Purans then that come to reside within this larger, Islamic salvation history. And what is also fascinating then is that Syed Sultan is now creating what could have been called a Quran salvation history. Yes, this is a term that comes up in the writings of medieval Bengali Muslim authors. What he is then creating is a Quran history of
you know, it's, It's equally fascinating and reassuring to hear you say that, in that initially I thought, well, I'm probably projecting much of my own object of study and methodology into this account. Of course, I don't know very much about the subfield that you're an expert in, so I thought, this is awfully Puranic in texture and flavor and frame narratives. So it's actually fantastic to hear you say, yes, in your expert opinion, it is. Who might benefit from reading this book?
So this, of course, could be widely used by, you know, people who study South Asia. More widely, I think it could be used by people interested in translation, yes, translation theorists, and so on and so forth. But of course, religious historians in general, and of course, Islamicists, I think would find the book interesting. So those are the broadly the key audiences for which the book has been written.
It's really is fascinating. Can you say a word for those wondering about the state of Islam in Bengal today?
So, of course, post 1947 and the partition of India, we have and we had, of course, the formation of East Pakistan, and then later on we had the growth and, you know, the 1971 War of Liberation that ultimately resulted in the creation of Bangladesh. So, of course, in Bangladesh, Islam is well and thriving, and we have a majority Muslim nation with barely 3% of the population, which is Hindu. So in that sense, but in some sense, you know, partition, of course, has skewed the ways in which we can think about Greater India and the pre-modern period, but I'll leave it there.
Oh, that's fascinating and important. And as I want to touch on that, it is quite literally works such as yours that warrant calling this more broadly a podcast on Indian religions, plural. Not even just Indic religions from Dharmic traditions, but sort of the religions that have taken root and have shaped what we think of as civilizational India.
If I may just add one important aspect of my book is the fact that I deal with a Chittagong that was ruled by the Arakanese sometime between the late 16th and mid 17th centuries. And of course, while I was writing the book, we had this great refugee migration of the Rohingyas. Some have called it, a genocidal war against the Rohingya populations of Myanmar. And today, many of these refugees are now housed in Bangladesh. And while I was sort of writing the conclusion to the book, it sort of, there was a tinge of nostalgia about a time when, you know, these borders and partitions did not exist, and there was a greater movement of peoples through the riverine networks of Bengal, and these kinds of rifts conflicts between the nation states that have now populated our globe didn't exist in an earlier period. Of course, wars still existed, but there was much greater movement of peoples across borders in an earlier period. So there was this sense of nostalgia as I completed the end of this book, particularly because I had been working with communities in Chittagong who had now reified Syed Sultan as a peer in their area. And they had, miraculously received the cot that Syed Sultan was supposed to have slept on from Arakan, where he is supposed to have died. And he sent this cot upriver along the Naaf River, which bifurcates Bangladesh from Arakan today. And, it is the same river that many, many of the Myanmarese could not, the Rohingya could not cross because of, government controls and the patrolling of that river. But that cot in a pre-modern period was sent up river and it reached in Chittagong. So about how rivers can become both, these spaces which connect as well as divide people.
That's a fascinating point. Is there anything else about the book that you had hoped we touch on?
I think we've covered, the most important salient features of the book. And thank you for taking the time to read it and help me think through it with you again.
You're most welcome. I have the easy part of asking the questions, don't I? great. No, it's a pleasure. It's a bit of a public service and a service to our colleagues who listen and engage. How appropriate the book is for teaching purposes, perhaps, or even research. So it really is a pleasure, and it's become this podcast began as sort of this favor, and then it was this kind of hobby, and now it's a little bit of a lifestyle.
Wonderful! It's certainly a service to the community at large, and our academic community as well.
Fantastic. So thank you very much for appearing today. For those of you listening, you're welcome. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Aisha Irani on her fascinating new OUP publication, The Muhammad Avatara. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the interplay between Islam and Indian religions. Take care.